Storm blows through.
Why are they dead?
Isolt asked.
Evraine seemed briefly surprised, and she glanced from Safi to Isolt, as if to verify the question was genuine. Upon seeing it was, Evraine frowned.
All of this coast was raised in the Great War. Kartoran earth witches poisoned the soils from the western border to the mouth of the River Timets.
Cold sank into Isolt's lungs. She glanced at Safi, whose horrified threads were shrinking inward.
Why?
Safi asked Evraine.
Have we never heard that before? We've studied Nubrevna, but our history books always describe this land as vibrant and alive.
Because, Evraine said, those who win wars are those who write history.
Still,
Safi said, voice rising, threads scattering outward.
If it was all a lie, I should have known it.
She grabbed hold of Isolt's hand, clenching so tight that it hurt through Isolt's painstone, throbbed into Isolt's wound. But the pain was refreshing. Isolt embraced it, glad that it made her spine straighten and her throat open. Her gaze settled on Evraine's saintly concentrated face as the monk cleaned her cleaving knife, the one Isolt had used. Sea fox blood still crusted the swirling steel. As Evraine scrubbed, her movements practiced and sure, Isolt was suddenly struck by how many knives Evraine must have wiped clean in her lifetime. She was a healer monk, but she was a fighter, too. And she'd lived at least half of her life during the Great War. When Isolt and Safi oiled their blades, they wiped away fingerprints and sweat, protected the steel against everyday handling. But when Evraine, and when Habim and Matthew, and even Gretcha, too, polished their swords, they scraped away blood and death, and a past Isolt couldn't imagine.
"Tell us," she said softly, "what happened to Nubrevna?"
"It started with the Kartorans," Evraine said simply, her words dancing away on the breeze. "Their earth witches tainted the soil. A week later, the Delmati Empire sent its water witches to poison the coast and the rivers. Last but hardly least, the Marstaki fire witches burned our entire eastern border to the ground."
"It was clearly a concerted effort, for you must understand. Lovats has never fallen. In all the centuries of war, the sentries of Noden and the water bridges of Stefan Eckhart have kept us safe.
So I suppose the Empires thought that if they briefly allied, they might topple us once and for all."
"But it didn't work," Isolt said.
"Not right away, no." Evraine's cleaning paused, and she stared into the middle distance. "The Empires focused their final attacks during the months leading up to the truce. Then, when their armies and navies were forced to withdraw, their magic was left behind to finish us off. The poison spread through the soil, moved upstream, while the Marstaki flames burned whole forests to the ground. Peasants and farmers were forced inland, as close as they could get to Lovat. But the city was already too crowded. Many died, and many more have died since. Our people are starving, girls, and the Empires are very close to toppling us once and for all." Isolt blinked.
There was finality in Evraine's voice, a rose-colored acceptance in her threads. Beside her, Safi's breath slithered out.
"Merrick truly needs this contract,"
she whispered, her voice devoid of emotion, her threads muted and frozen, as if she were too shocked to feel.
"Yet my uncle has made it impossible for him to claim. It's too specific. No spilled blood."
A pause hung in the air. The wind and the shouts of the sailors dulled. Then, suddenly, it all snapped forward. Too fast. Too bright. Safi lurched away from the bulwark, her threads avalanching outward with more colors than Isolde could follow. Red guilt, orange panic, gray fear, and blue regret. These weren't the frayed threads that break, but rather the tough reaching threads that build. Each emotion, no matter the color, surged out of her, reaching across the deck as if trying to connect with someone, anyone, who might feel as wildly as she. Then Sophie turned to Isolde and said in a voice made of stone and winter,
"I'm so sorry, Isolde."
Her gaze slid to Merrick and she said it again.
"I'm so sorry I dragged you into this."
Before Isolde could assuage, could argue that none of this was Sophie's fault, a white thread flared in the corner of her eyes. Terror. She jerked around right as Cullen, standing on the main deck, started to cough. Then doubled over. Then fell. Isolde ran for him, Sophie and Evrain on her heels. They reached Cullen as a girl with braids did too, her skin a stark contrast to Cullen's deathly pallor. Yet Merrick was already there, already pulling Cullen into a sitting position and massaging the man's back. Massaging his lungs, Isolde realized, as she skidded to a stop several paces away. Sophie paused beside her. Evrain, however, pushed all the way to Cullen and dropped to a crouch.
"I'm here, Cullen," Merrick said, voice ragged.
His threads burned with the same white terror as Cullen's.
"I'm here. Relax your lungs and the air will come."
The first mate's mouth worked like a fish, gulping at nothing. Though air seemed to squeak out, he could get no breath in, and each cough that shattered through him was weaker than the last. Then, eyes huge and cheeks pale, Cullen turned to Merrick and shook his head. Sophie dropped to the deck beside them.
"How can I help?"
She looked first at Merrick, then to the girl, and finally to Cullen, who stared back at her. But the first mate could only wag his head at Sophie before his eyes rolled back, and he fell forward into Merrick's arms. Instantly, Merrick and the younger girl flipped him onto his back, and Merrick tipped Cullen's mouth wide. He lowered his lips to Cullen's, and then exhaled full gusts of magicked air into his thread brother's throat. Over and over he did this, an eternity of puffing and heaving, of urgent, terrified threads. Sailors gathered around, though they seemed smart enough to hang back. Sophie threw a panicked look at Isolde, but Isolde could offer no solutions. She had never seen anything like this before. Then a tremble moved through Cullen's chest. He was breathing. Merrick gaped for several long seconds at Cullen's ribs before doubling over in relief. His threads blazed with the pink light of Thread Brothers, pure and dazzling.
"Thank you, Nodin," he mumbled into Cullen's chest. "Oh, Nodin, thank you."
The same sentiment shimmered through the threads of every sailor, through Sophie's and Devrain's as well. Yet none were so bright as Merrick's or the girls, and the girls shone with the pure red of a heart thread.
"Let me check him,"
Evrain said with a gentle hand on Merrick's back.
"To be sure he did not damage something."
Merrick shot up, his face contorted with fury, and his threads... Isolde flinched from the force.
"You disobeyed my orders," he shouted at his aunt. "You jeopardized my ship and my men. The Domna was my only bargaining card."
Evrain stood still, threads calm.
"We needed a Fire Witch healer for Isolde. She would have died without one." "We all would have died."
Merrick pushed Evrain again. She didn't resist.
"You abandoned your post with no thought for others."
Sophie's threads blazed into a defensive fury. She sprang to her feet.
"It wasn't her fault. She was only doing what I ordered."
Merrick swiveled towards Sophie.
"Is that so, Domna? So, You weren't fleeing your betrothed? You weren't avoiding capture, truth witch?
Cold tunneled through Isolde's stomach, down her muscles. But how did he know?
Doesn't matter,
Isolde told herself, already bending her knees to lunge for Safi, to protect her. Until Safi's threads flared with beige uncertainty, as if she might try to hide this truth from Merrick. So Isolde schooled her face into absolute thread-witch calm. She would not betray Safi's secret.
Where did you hear that rumor?
Safi finally asked, her words careful and even.
The Marstocks know.
Merrick leaned toward her.
Their voice which kindly told mine. Do you deny it?
The world dragged, as if Safi's inner debate spread around her. The breeze became soft and distant.
Don't admit it. Please don't admit it.
It was one thing for Emperor Henrik to possibly know of Safi's witchery, but there was no reason for the whole world to learn, too.
What if Merrick decided to use her, or to marry her, as Henrik had?
Or what if Merrick decided to kill Safi instead, before an enemy could lay claim to her? Yet as Safi's threads melted from gray fear to a lush, determined green, Isolde's breath rolled out with defeat.
So what?
Safi squared her shoulders.
So what if I am a truth witch, Admiral? What difference does it make?
In a burst of speed, Merrick grabbed Safi's wrists, flipped her around, and wrenched her arms behind her.
It makes all the difference, he snarled. You told me no one sought you. You told me you were not important, and yet you're a truth witch betrothed to Emperor Henrik.
He pushed her arms further back. Safi's face tightened. But when Isolde tipped forward to defend, to fight for her thread sister, Safi shook her head in warning. When Safi spoke again, her tone and threads were shockingly controlled.
I thought that if you knew who I was, you would turn me over to the Kartorins.
Why?
Merrick leaned in close, his face inches from Safi's.
Your magic knows when I speak the truth, Domna. And I told you I never intended harm. All I want is to get food to my people. Why is that so hard for anyone?
His voice cracked. He paused, his threads melting from crimson rage to deep blue sadness.
I've lost my tied witches now, Domna, and the Marstocks hunt me.
All I have left are my ship, my loyal sailors, and my first mate.
But you almost took them away from me, too.
Safi's mouth opened as if to argue, but Merrick wasn't finished.
We could have escaped as soon as the Sea Foxes arrived. Instead, we almost died because you were not in your cabin like you should have been. I had to find you, and that left us as bait for the Foxes. Your recklessness almost killed my crew.
But Isolde
would have been fine.
Merrick dipped her back, and Safi's posture wilted. I plan to get your friend a Fire Witch healer as soon as we hit New Brevenant soil.
You know this is true, don't you? Your witchery must tell you so.
Safi met Merrick's gaze. Then, threads burning with brilliant blue regret and guilty red, she nodded.
I see it.
Merrick's temper erupted once more. He seized Safi and ordered, Move! To Isolde's complete shock, Safi did move, her threads melting into Merrick's and shimmering with hints of a brighter red. Isolde's lips parted, her foot rising to charge after Safi, to stop Merrick from doing whatever it was he'd planned. A hand clasped her wrist.
Don't!
She jerked her head around and found the girl with the braids shaking her head.
Don't interfere,
she said in a hollow voice.
A few hours in the irons won't kill her.
In the what?
Isolt whipped around, and nausea swelled in her stomach at the sight of Merrick pushing Sophie down, yanking out her legs, and locking her ankles in straps of iron. The enormous fetters groaned shut, locks clicked, and Sophie could do nothing but stare across the ship at Isolt. Again, Isolt lurched forward, but this time an older sailor sidestepped her.
Leave her there, girl, or you'll be locked in him, too.
As if to prove the point, Evrain shot forward, roaring,
You cannot do this to her, Merrick. She is a Domna of Kartora, not a new Brevnan.
Merrick straightened and motioned vaguely at his sailors, though his eyes stayed on his aunt.
You are a new Brevnan, though, and your disobedience will not go unpunished either.
Evrain's threads turned turquoise with surprise as two sailors jostled her to a second set of leg irons. While the sailors pushed down Evrain and tightened the manacles, Merrick turned as if to walk away.
You would resort to torturing a Domna, Evrain shouted. You will harm her, Merrick. You will ruin your own contract.
Merrick paused, glancing back at his aunt.
I resort to punishment, not torture. She knew the consequences for disobedience. And, he added, lethally calm now, what sort of admiral, what sort of prince would I be if I didn't uphold my own laws? The Domna has survived a sea fox attack unscathed, so a few hours in the irons will cause no damage. But it will give her time to consider the hell she has brought here.
I didn't mean to, Sophie said, eyes on Merrick. I never meant to hurt you or Cullen or New Brevna. I didn't know about the Marstocks. I swear it, Admiral. My uncle told me no one would follow.
Isolt's jaw slackened as she watched on. The threads over Sophie's and Merrick's heads throbbed with a harsh, urgent need. Sophie's threads grabbed for Merrick's, and his wrapped and twined into hers. Right before Isolt's eyes, Sophie's threads were changing from those that build into those that bind. In two long steps, Merrick was back to Sophie's side and crouching down. He stared hard into her eyes. She stared back.
If not for Cullen's magic, we would all be dead right now. And it was your impulsive disobedience that almost killed us. That cannot go unpunished. There is still a contract with your family, and one way or another, I will get you to Lejna. Then I will feed my country.
For a heartbeat, then two, the space between Merrick and Sophie, the threads burning between them, ignited into a full, flaming thread of scarlet. But Isolt had no time to distinguish the exact shade. If it was a growing thread of love or one of unforgiving hate, before the color was gone again, and she was left wondering if she hadn't imagined the entire thing. It was almost funny how fast Sophie went from standing upright to being locked like a battered dog in the irons. Stuck. Trapped. Unmoving. And she hadn't fought at all. She'd just given in, wondering why she was accepting these fetters so easily, wondering when she'd lost her ability to attack, to run. If she couldn't run properly, then what did she have left from her old life? Her happy life full of tarot and coffee and daydreams? All of her hopes for freedom had scorched away. No place of her own with Isolt. No escaping Emperor Henrik's court or her Uncle Aaron's schemes or a life as a fugitive truth witch. But Isolt would live. Her wound was healed and she would live. That made it all worth it. Didn't it? Sophie watched her thread sister, who was scrambling after Merrick across the deck, pleading with him, her face blank despite the sailors recoiling from her path. Merrick ignored her and climbed to the quarter deck. He took his spot at the helm and ordered the wind drum to resume. And Isolde gave up. She stopped her chase at the companionway and twisted around to meet Safi's eyes, looking even more helpless than she had when she'd been dying. Rain started to fall, a gentle whisper on Safi's skin that should have soothed but felt like acid instead. Safi was falling into herself. The world was pulsing at her. She couldn't move her legs. She was trapped here, inside herself. Forever, she would be this person, stuck within this body and this mind, tied down by her own mistakes and broken promises.
"This is why they all leave you. Your parents, your uncle, Habim and Matthew, Merrick."
The prince's name pounded in Safi's ears, roared with her blood in time to the rain, in time to the drum. He only wanted to save his homeland, yet Safi hadn't cared. Not about Merrick, not about all the lives depending on him. Isolde stumbled over the deck towards Safi, her face pinched and pale. She was the only person Safi had left, the only piece from her old life. But how long before Isolde gave up, too? Isolde reached Safi and dropped to her knees.
"He won't listen to me."
"You need rest," Evrain said. "Go to the cabin."
Safi flinched. Her chains rattled. She'd forgotten the monk was fettered beside her. She'd been so caged in her own skin, she'd forgotten everyone else. Like she always did. It was Safi's selfish greed that had put a price on Isolde's head, that had forced Isolde to leave Vinyatsa City, and somehow earned a cursed arrow in the arm, too. Then, when Safi had fought for Isolde, had done everything she could to compensate and to save her other half from the damage she'd wrought, Safi had ended up hurting someone else. Lots of someones. Her tunnel vision had led her down a broken path. Now, Merrick, Cullen, and his entire crew were paying for it. With that thought, Uncle Aaron's words from Vinyatsa City settled over Safi's heart.
"When the chimes toll midnight, you can do whatever you please and live out the same unambitious existence you've always enjoyed."
She had done just that, hadn't she? At midnight, she had dropped the Act of Domna. She'd resumed her old impulsive, oblivious existence. But Safi refused to accept that. She refused to be what Aaron or anyone else expected her to be. She was stuck in this body with this mind, but it didn't mean she couldn't reach outside. It didn't mean she couldn't change. She met Isolde's eyes, sagging and overbright in the twilight.
"Go to the cabin," she ordered. "You need to get out of the rain." "But you..."
Isolde scooted closer, goose flesh on her rain-slick arms.
"I can't leave you like this. Please, Is, if you don't heal, then all of this will have been for nothing."
Safi forced a laugh.
"I'll be fine. This is nothing compared to Habim's jab drills."
Isolde didn't offer the smile Safi had hoped for, but she did nod and unsteadily push to her feet.
"I'll check on you at the next chime."
She looked at Evrain and lifted her wrist.
"Do you want the pain stone back?"
Evrain gave a tiny shake of her head.
"You'll need it to fall asleep."
"Thank you."
Isolde looked once more at Safi, stared hard into Safi's eyes.
"It'll be all right,"
she said simply.
"We'll make it all right again. I promise."
Then she hugged her arms to her chest and walked away, leaving Safi with the rising tide of her truth witchery. Because somehow, they would make it all right again. 27. In the 7 hours since the Kartoran cutter had set sail from Vinyatsa City, the sun had set, the moon had risen, and Edwin had not stopped puking. His only consolation was that this misery had sparked a story among the void-fearing sailors on board. Blood witches can't cross water.
Yes. Let them spread that rumor at every port they visited.
It was just as Edwin had transitioned into welcome dry heaves that the cutter came upon four destroyed naval vessels, three of them Marstaki and one New Brevnen. Despite Edwin's most snarling protests that Safiya von Hastrel was not upon these ships, Prince Leopold insisted on stopping anyway. For it would seem that the Empress of Marstock was on board, and Leopold wanted Edwin to join him on that ship. When none of the Hellbards opposed this madness, not even the commander, a lazy, irreverent young man named Fitzkrieg, Edwin soon found himself flying to the Empress's galleon via Windwitch. There, 10 adders gave him and Leopold a casual once-over. The adders made no move to claim any weapons, though, before leading their visitors to the Empress's cabin. Clearly, they were confident that neither Leopold nor Edwin stood any chance against their poison witch darts. Edwin recognized some of the adders. By blood smell alone, though, since he could see no faces behind their headscarves. Their zigzagged swords, like flames of steel, flickered in the fire witch lamps across the deck. Stupid weapons. They were unwieldy and unnecessary, especially when an adder's best advantage was his or her poison witchery. Their power over poison was such a dark subset of water witchery, a corruption of water witch healers, Edwin had once heard. Yet it was Edwin's power that was considered void magic. Edwin was the one called demon. It had always struck him as unfair. Then again, it also worked in his favor. Once inside the Empress's cabin, the adders settled evenly around the room and against the walls. A low, unadorned table and two benches were at the room's center, and beside one stood the Empress of Marstock. She was smaller than Edwin had realized, having only seen her from afar. Yet despite her delicate bones, her blood scent was unyielding. Desert sage and sandstone walls, the blacksmith's anvil and gall ink. It was the scent of an iron witch, a powerful one, as well as a woman of education. And despite the fact that Vanis's fleet was in shambles, she wore a fresh white gown, and her expression was coolly civil. Edwin settled into a wide-legged stance behind the second bench, calculating the best exits from the cabin as he did so, and the Empress smiled. It breezed over her lips, as if she and Leopold were merely meeting on the dance floor. The Empress must have known who and what Edwin was, yet she made no comment on his presence, gave no indication that she found it odd Leopold lacked any sort of hellbard escort. Clearly, she was an expert at appearances, each expression a careful mask designed to keep the power of the room in her slender hands. But why bother? Edwin wondered. If she was as powerful an Iron Witch as the stories claimed, then she didn't need tricks to get her way. The older Carowin monks still spoke of the day she destroyed Kendura Pass. The day she tapped into a magic so vast and so fearless that she toppled an entire mountain. And she'd only been 7 years old. Edwin took that as a sign this meeting was peacefully intended.
"I will take some Marstaki dates, if I may," said Prince Leopold.
He hovered beside the table, seemingly more interested in examining his jacket cuffs than in speaking with Vanis. Yet the mask Leopold wore was clumsy and overdone. It was like the prince played at being royalty while the empress simply was. Vanis motioned to the bench, the iron of her bracelets rattling.
"Have a seat, Prince Leopold. I will have candies brought in."
"Thank you,
your holiest of holies.
Leopold flashed her a bright grin, and with the sigh of someone who has worked a long, hard day, he sank onto the bench. Its black wood creaked.
Venice swept onto the bench opposite him. Her spine straight, she cocked her head to one side, waiting. Her pause was quickly rewarded by a serving boy, who scurried in with a plate of sugared fruit. Leopold snatched up one, moaned displeasure, and then snapped up two more. Seconds slid into minutes. And though Edwin had no doubt the prince meant this as some sort of insult, the empress showed only patience, which was more than Edwin could lay claim to. If Leopold's point in coming was to offer petty insults, then this detour was an even greater waste of Edwin's time than he'd first feared. At this rate, Safia von Hostrel would reach the sentries of Noden before Leopold even finished downing his candies. On the fourth fruit, Venice's face slid into a narrow-browed frown.
"When I said that my fleet was hurt," she said politely, "I had hoped for your assistance. Perhaps I was not clear."
Leopold bared his usual flash of a grin and wiped a slow thumb over his lips. "But surely your most majestic of majesties realizes that sugar can improve even the most dire of situations."
He offered her a fig.
"I am not hungry."
"One needn't be hungry to enjoy these."
Leopold shoved the candy at her once more.
"Taste one. They're almost as divine as your beauty."
She bowed her head respectfully, and to Edwin's surprise, she accepted a sugared fruit. She even went so far as to nibble off a corner. Edwin ran his tongue over his teeth, at a loss for how to interpret this behavior. Leopold clearly wished to anger Venice, yet she deftly avoided taking his bait, which meant whatever she wanted was important, and whatever she wanted, she got. So why drag this out? Why keep a veneer of serenity with a power like hers? Edwin certainly never bothered. Leopold seemed to think the same, for on his sixth date, he abandoned his game. With poorly veiled annoyance, he slouched back and crossed his legs.
"What happened to your fleet, your worshipped?"
"Sea foxes," she said simply,
which earned a laugh from the prince.
"Sea foxes," he repeated, eyebrows rising. "You expect me to believe that? Did shadow worms and flame hawks get you as well? Or let me guess, the 12 returned with their wicked swords and bashed a hole in the hull."
Venice showed no reaction, yet the air in the room seemed to contract. The adders stiffened, and Edwin's hand moved to his sword hilt.
"Flame hawks are still present in Marstock," Venice said, her tone as smooth as before, her mask preserved. "And it would seem that the sea foxes have returned."
Edwin's eyes flitted to Leopold, trying to gauge the prince's reaction. Edwin had heard of sea foxes, yet as far as he knew, there hadn't been any sightings for decades. For once, though, Leopold remained silent and unreadable. So Venice continued.
"I am due in Asmir, Your Highness, but I fear it would take my men too long to repair our fleet's damage. I ask that you lend us tide witches from your crew. We have none left."
"Then why," Edwin mused wryly, "do I detect at least 3 tide witch scents below decks?"
There was no mistaking them. They smelled of high water marks and river rapids. As Edwin considered how best to inform Leopold of the Empress's lie, Leopold flourished his hands.
"Your imperial perfection," he murmured. "I couldn't help but notice an intact ship in your fleet. It didn't match your other ships. In fact, it looked... what did we say?"
Leopold threw a pointed glance at Edwin, one that made it clear he didn't expect a response. Then the prince snapped his fingers.
It looked New Brevnen. That was it. I wonder, your imperial perfection, how it came to be in your possession.
We found the warship by chance,
Venice answered smoothly.
It must have been attacked by sea foxes as well.
Then surely,
Leopold propped his elbows on his knees.
Its dead crew will not mind if you take it ashore.
For half a breath, Venice froze. She did not speak, blink, or even breathe. Then she shot to her feet, bracelets clattering and a new mask settling into place. Anger. Or perhaps it was no mask, for when Idwin sucked in a full breath, he sensed her pulse was faster, hotter.
You would deny me help, she said softly. I, who am the Empress of the Flame Children, the chosen daughter of the Firewell, the most worshipped of the Marstocks.
She stretched both her hands on the table with such poise that not a single iron link clanked.
I, who am the destroyer of Kendura Pass. To deny me is to ignite your own funeral pyre, Prince Leopold. You do not want me as an enemy.
I wasn't aware we were allies.
Venice's body tautened like a waiting snake, and Edwin instinctively summoned his own magic, a mere ripple that would leave his eyes clear of red. If this moment escalated, Edwin would lock down the Empress in a heartbeat. Leopold tipped a single finger at Venice.
Here is the situation as I see it, your highest of highs. First, I think that you are following my uncle's betrothed, because why else would you abandon a truce summit at which you are supposed to be? Second,
he unfurled another finger.
I think you met Safiya's kidnappers here and engaged in a battle that somehow fell between the truce's cracks.
Leopold flexed a third finger, frowning now.
I cannot sort out this third finger, which is the reason for it all. Safiya cannot possibly hold any value for you, your most beloved.
The air in the room tightened even more. Venice's chest expanded, but then Edwin felt her blood cool, her fury back in control.
I, she murmured, do not want your uncle's betrothed, Prince Leopold.
And I,
Leopold flowed to his feet, towering over the Empress by a full head and a half.
Do not believe you, Empress Venice.
Magic rushed out, faster than Edwin could ever have guessed. It stripped three knives from his baldric, launched them over the bench, and aimed them at Leopold's neck, heart, and stomach. Edwin's power roared to life. His blood reached for Venice. His body tensed for action. But in a slippery whisper, 10 adders unholstered their blowguns and aimed them at Edwin and Leopold. Edwin's gaze raced back over the room, mind groping for an escape route. He could control Venice, but he'd still end up with a chest full of poison or steel. And although Edwin would survive, Leopold would not. The prince lifted a cool hand, no sign of fear in his voice, or, to Edwin's surprise, in his blood.
If you find Safiya von Hostrel before I do, Empress, you will return her to me immediately, or you will face the consequences.
Do you love your uncle's plaything so much?
Venice flipped up one palm, and the knife at Leopold's neck drew back several inches.
Do you value her life so highly that you would risk my displeasure?
Though the prince's lips twisted up, there was no amusement in his smile.
I have known Safiya von Hostrel my entire life, your royal perfection. She will make an incredible leader when the time comes, the kind who puts her nation before herself.
His eyes flicked significantly to Venice's bracelets.
So mark my words, chosen daughter of the Fire Well. If you do not give me the future Empress, then I will come to Marstock and I will claim her myself. Now lower your blades before I accidentally step into one. That will erase your name from the 20-year truce, I can assure you.
A rigid pause stretched through the room, and Edwin kept his witchery quaking high. Ready. Ready. The blades lazily twirled back. Then they slid away and fell. Edwin caught the nearest from the air, but the other two hit the table, the bench. As he snatched them up, Leopold dipped forward to pluck another candied fruit.
Thank you for the treats, great destroyer.
He smiled blandly.
It's always such a pleasure to see you.
Without another word, and with the squared shoulders of a man in charge, Leopold IV strode for the door.
Come, monk, he called. We have lost time, and we must now make it up.
Edwin marched after Leopold, his eyes and his power never leaving the Empress or her adders. Yet no one made any attempt to stop Leopold or Edwin as they departed, and moments later the men were rocketing off the splintered Marstocki galleon. Once firmly on their cutter again, and with Leopold shouting for Commander Fitzkrieg to fetch him clean breeches, Edwin watched the prince through slitted, distrustful eyes.
The Empress, Edwin said once the Hellbard commander had vanished below decks, lied about having tide witches on board.
I assumed so.
Leopold scowled at an invisible mark on his cuff.
She also lied about not wanting Safiya von Hastro.
But,
Leopold glanced up, I have one advantage over the Empress. Edwin's eyebrows lifted.
I have you, Monk Edwin, and trust me when I say that that has the Empress of Marstock now sailing scared.
28.
Keep the light steady,
Merrick bellowed from the tiller. Two sailors aimed the Jonna's spotlights on the waves. The moon gave some light when the clouds bothered to part, but it wasn't enough, especially not with the lingering rain. Without Cullen to fill the Jonna's sails or Merrick's witches to carry her hull, Merrick had to push his meager crew hard, and push himself hard, too. But he had no other choice, and time was short. He needed to find that one jagged peak, the lonely bastard, as he and Cullen had always called it, before the tide swallowed it whole. Behind it was a hidden cove, a family secret that would allow Merrick's crew to rest in safety. If the Jonna missed the tide, though, Merrick would be forced to wait until tomorrow afternoon, allowing the Marstocks or the Sea Foxes to catch up. Merrick's gaze snapped to the Domna and Evrain, still chained. Safiya's golden hair was damp and hanging, his aunt's white cloak soaked to gray. For once, Isolde was nowhere to be seen. She'd checked on Safiya and Evrain 100 times during the first 4 hours of their punishment. In the last 2 chimes, though, the girl had stayed below decks. Sleeping, probably. Merrick was glad for it. Each time Isolde had come to beg for Safi's release, the muscles in his neck had hardened. His shoulders had strained toward his ears, and he'd patted his pocket, checking that the Hastral agreement was still tucked inside. Those pages had become his last hope for salvation, so he kept them close. He checked the document for the 1,000th time now, the pages flattened and rain-splattered. The signatures were intact, so Merrick would leave Safiya in her chains a bit longer. He might not be Vivia when it came to discipline, but there were consequences for disobedience. Merrick's crew knew that, expected it even. So Merrick couldn't suddenly go soft. even if there might be long-term repercussions for binding a woman who would one day be Empress of Kartora, even if Safiya and her betrothed Henrik could make Merrick pay for this sort of treatment. Merrick didn't care. He'd rather keep his crew's respect than worry over what some idiot emperor could do to a country that was already crippled. Henrik. Merrick had always disliked that foul old man. To think that Safiya was his betrothed. To think she would marry, would bed, a man three times her age. Merrick couldn't reconcile that thought. He'd believed Safiya was different from other nobility. Impulsive, yes, but loyal, too. And perhaps as alone as Merrick was in a world of cutthroat political games. But it turned out Safiya was just like the rest of the Kartoran domes and domnas. She lived with blinders on, attuned only to those she deemed worthy. Yet even as Merrick nursed his fury, even as he told himself he loathed Safiya, he couldn't keep the butts from churning in his stomach. But you would have done the same for Colin. You would have risked lives to save him. But maybe she doesn't want to marry Henrik or be Empress. Maybe she is on the run to avoid it. Merrick shoved aside those arguments. The simple fact remained that if Safiya had only told Merrick of her betrothal from the beginning, he could have returned her to Dalmati and been done with her immediately. He never would have been on this side of Jadansi, where he'd been forced to fight a sea fox, battle the Marstocks, and ultimately push Cullen too hard.
Admiral.
Herman hobbled onto the quarterdeck, expression bleak.
I still can't make a connection with the Lovat's voice witches.
Oh. Mechanically, Merrick brushed rain off his coat. Herman had been linked into the voice witch threads for hours, trying to get through to Lovat's, to King Seraphin.
Might be.
Herman mused, tipping his voice over the waves and rain, the squeak of ropes and the grunts of seamen.
That all the voice witches are busy.
In the middle of the night? Merrick frowned.
Or maybe,
Herman went on,
my magic is the problem. Maybe I'm too old.
Merrick's frown deepened to a scowl. Age didn't diminish a witchery. Herman knew it and Merrick knew it too. So if the old man was trying to soften what was obviously going on, that the voice witches in Lovat's were ignoring Merrick's calls, then there was no point. If Vivia's words turned out to be true, and Merrick's father really had ordered the ether-witched miniature, then Merrick would deal with that later. For now, he just had to get his man ashore and away from Marstocky flames. He glanced at the leg irons, at Safiya, only to find Ryber crouched beside her.
Take the helm,
Merrick snarled, already stalking for the companionway. Then he lifted his voice in a roar.
Ryber! Get away from there!
The ship's girl jerked to attention, yet Safiya kept her head bowed as Merrick slammed onto the main deck and advanced on Ryber.
You, he growled. Should be swabbing.
He thrust a finger at the nearby new recruit, who diligently scrubbed water off the deck.
That is your duty, Ryber. So if I catch you shirking again, you'll be whipped. Understand?
The Domna lifted her chin.
I called Ryber over here, she rasped.
Someone needs to check on Isolde,
Evrain inserted, her voice hoarse.
The girl is still healing.
Merrick ignored Safiya and Evrain, his fingers reaching for his collar.
Swab the deck, he told Ryber. Now.
Ryber saluted, and once she was out of sight, Merrick wheeled toward the Domna, ready to shout that she leave his sailors alone. But her head was tipped back, her eyes closed and mouth open. Even with only lantern light to shine on her skin, There was no missing the wobble in her throat, the flick of her tongue. She was drinking the rain. Merrick's rage vanished. Dread swallowed it whole, and he tore out the Hastral agreement. The signatures were still there.
Of course they are, he thought, annoyed with himself for caring. Sophia isn't bleeding.
Yet his fingers trembled, and distantly he wondered why that might be. Perhaps this fear had nothing to do with the contract. That thought tickled at the base of his skull, and he hastily tamped it down, buried it deep, and returned the contract to his pocket. Then he dug out the leg iron keys. Whatever the reason for this hollow fear, Merrick would dwell on it later, along with his unshakable worry over King Seraphin, Vivia, and Cullen. Right now, though, this punishment had to end. Crouching beside Sophia, Merrick unlocked the first fetter. She seemed wearily surprised.
I am free.
Free to stay locked in your cabin.
Merrick undid the remaining irons and then stood.
Get up.
She drew in her soaked legs and tried to rise. The ship rocked. She toppled forward. Merrick lunged for her. Her skin was slick and cold, her body shivering. With a grunt, he hefted her up, cradled her close. His men watched on, and Merrick didn't miss the nod of approval from Herman as he strode toward the ladder below decks. The Domna had served her punishment. The men respected that. Sophia's face was near, her eyelashes thick and wet. Her damp clothes rubbed against Merrick's skin, and her breaths were shallow. Merrick firmly ignored it all, focusing on getting one foot in front of the next, until at last he pushed into the darkened passenger room. Isolt slept, shuddering on her pallet.
Is,
Sophia murmured, shifting in Merrick's arms and straining for her thread sister. Merrick carried her to the pallet, bent slightly, and then dropped her. She fell beside Isolt, who shook awake. As Isolt scrambled to help Sophia, Merrick whirled about and left the room, telling himself that Sophia was taken care of, that he wouldn't think of her now, that he wouldn't think of her ever again. Yet when at last he reached the tiller of his father's ship and caught sight of the lonely bastard piercing the horizon ahead, his arms were still warm, his neck still humming from Sophia's grip. Before Safi had returned, Isolt had been trapped in her nightmares again.
Sever, sever, twist and sever. Fingers tore at Isolt, yanked at her hair, her dress, her flesh. Threads that break, threads that die. An arrow ripped through her arm. Pain exploded through her entire being. And magic, magic, black, festering magic.
Nasty dream you're having.
The shadow's voice jolted Isolt from the nightmare.
You tremble and quake so much today,
the shadow continued, a syrup on its voice that was overly gleeful.
What upsets you? It wasn't just a dream. You have that one all the time.
Isolt tried to turn away, but every direction she shifted, the shadow followed. Every kick or mental thrust, the shadow avoided. Every desperate retreat, the shadow dug its talons in deeper. And on the shadow babbled. Or rather, she babbled, for the shadow was a woman. A fellow thread witch, convinced that she and Isolt were somehow alike. It was that talk that frightened Isolt the most. The possibility that this strange voice was like her, that maybe the shadow understood Isolt's private pains more than anyone else. Which, of course, made Isolt wonder if she wasn't just imagining the entire thing, going crazy while all of her hopes for the future trickled away between her fingers. Or maybe Isolt was finally buckling beneath the threads of the world, Her ordinary heart pounded to dust.
"You are upset about your tribe,"
the shadow declared matter-of-factly, stumbling on Izzult's most recent memories.
"My tribe pushed me out too, you know, because I wasn't like the other thread witches. I couldn't make threadstones or control my feelings, so the tribe didn't want me. That's why you left yours, isn't it?"
The curiosity on the shadow's voice was double-edged. Izzult knew she shouldn't answer. Yet she couldn't help it when the shadow asked again.
"That's why you left, isn't it?"
The urge to tell the truth, about her shame with Gretcha, her jealousy of Alma, tickled Izzult's throat. Why couldn't she fight this shadow?
"Use that frustration,"
she told herself almost frantically.
"Use that to fight her."
Izzult ripped her dream body sideways and latched on to the first mindless memory she could find. Her multiplication tables.
9 times 1 equals 9. 9 times 2 equals 18.
But the shadow simply laughed.
"It's silly that we're expected to feel nothing,"
the shadow continued, her tone dulcet once more.
"I don't believe the stories. The ones that say we don't have heart threads and thread families. Of course we do. We just can't see them, is all. Why would the Moon Mother give all of her children such powerful bonds, but then exclude us?" "I don't know."
Izzult was grateful for that easy question. If she answered it, if she seemed to cooperate, maybe the shadow would leave. She didn't. Instead, the shadow laughed her gleeful laugh and cried,
"Why, look! Talking of thread families upsets you, Izzult. Why?
Why?"
9 times 4 equals 36. 9 times 5.
"Oh, it's your mother and her apprentice. They have left you hurt and broken. Goodness, Izzult, you are so easy to read. All your fears gather at the surface, and I can skim them off like fat from a Borg chapot.
Here,
I see that you couldn't make threadstones, so your mother sent you away, and oh, what is this?"
The shadow was exultant now. And no matter how wildly Izzult fought, she couldn't keep her thoughts locked away.
"Gretcha and Alma planned their escape before you were even gone. And Izzult, look here. She tried to claim she loved you. Well, she obviously didn't love you enough to take you with her."
"She manipulated you quite well, Izzult, just as her job entailed. Just as our job entails. We must weave threads when we can, and break them when we have to.
It's the only way to untangle the loom."
The shadow's voice lowered to a whisper, a sound like wind through a graveyard.
"Mark my words, Izzult. Your mother will never love you, and that monk you admire so much, she will never understand you and Safiya. Oh, Safiya, she will leave you one day. One day soon, I think. But you can change that."
The shadow dragged out a pause, and Izzult imagined she was smiling as she did so.
"You can change the very weave of the world. Grab hold of Safi's threads, Izzult. Break them before they hurt you."
"No,"
Izzult hissed.
"I've had enough of you. I've had enough."
With every ounce of power in her muscles and her mind, Izzult opened her mouth in the real world and said,
9 times 8 equals 72.
The world plowed into her, carrying pain from her arm and the sound of footsteps. A Safi's voice. Izzult opened her eyes, and Safi toppled into her. Safi shivered from the rain, and try as she might, she couldn't seem to analyze her terrain, to evaluate her opponents. And there was something about strategy she was supposed to consider, too.
"You're freezing," Isolde said. "Get under the blanket."